This is a session on great scenes from great literature, and tonight we're using Barabbas, and my name is Paul Olson, and the title of the talk is Barabbas. Barabbas is us. Are we freed or are we condemned? It was a Nobel Prize winner, but maybe not so well known just because I think it's Swedish, writings in that language don't lend themselves to the international review quite as much as English does, and then some of the famous Russian writers and Southern European writers too. Well, before we start in the book exactly, and there are lots of themes going on here, and you'll pick up many more when you read it than we will tonight in this one-hour survey, which really will be about 20 minutes of me and a lot of you, I hope. Survey of this novel. Let's start with a question among ourselves about how we think we would define faith. How would you, and I'm not looking for anything academic now, just I think the beginning analysis of all good literature, I mean the beginning analysis of good analysis is come from your guts first. So how would you define what faith is? Okay, maybe I'll act as your recording secretary here, and I'll write these things. Trust, okay? A belief that you act upon. Okay.
Keeps you going.
Okay. Not only what you do with it, but anything you want to go with it. Okay? Yeah. Convictions. I'll just write short note of it, not knowing, and I'll underline know, because that is indeed one of the themes that runs through this novel. And I think a lot of great writers deal with it as kind of hidden away in their themes, but what is the way to knowledge? And in our Western society, very often the way to knowledge is through intellect. And we avoid often other ways to come to knowledge, like inspiration, like revelation, like intuition. Poets live in that world all the time, but you can find the truth through intuition. But we're not very often there. Barabbas for sure isn't. Barabbas has real difficulties dealing with things he doesn't know about and doesn't understand. That's good. Anything else? Okay, good. Nice word for it, elusive. For all of us, no matter where our faith is, isn't it true? It's there and then it's gone most of the time, and then we just have these moments. Matter of fact, did we just hear something about that? Yeah, Elmer, milliseconds. I guess that was in a Bible study. Milliseconds of faith. Good. Anybody else? Okay, that ties in with here, knowing it ain't so, good. Believing what you know ain't so, that's a nice phrase. Good. Okay, I'll read the opening scene from Barabbas, which is going to underline, I think, some of the things you've already talked about. Now, let's refresh our memory for everyone. Barabbas is in the Bible. Who is he?
He was one of them to be crucified in Christ's place, and they didn't want him, they wanted Christ.
Yeah.
And he sees what's going on here.
Very good. And then you've added that nice touch to it that, and he sees this going on and knows, how did I do that? Well, that's the fictional account that's so wonderful. And this whole book just, you know, in 3 hours of reading, we'll push it all night now. In 3 hours of reading, you can have it done and find out what it must have been like as Parlographist imagines this guy's incredible journey to, I was condemned to die, and through no fault or abilities of my own, I'm free. Well, the title of this little lecture, this little discussion will be Free or Is He Condemned? And we'll talk about that. Well, Logarthist style is disconcerting in that it's so simple. Don't let it throw you. It's wonderful. That's why he's great. But beneath the simplicity is our profound discussions of poignant ideas. This is what I'd like every freshman in my freshman writing courses to read and learn how to write like Logarthist. You can say the most poignant, powerful ideas in the simplest way. You know, I tell students, don't talk to me in education. Okay, everyone knows how they hung there on the crosses and who they were that stood gathered around him. Mary and his mother and Mary Magdalene, Veronica, Simon of Cyrene who carried the cross, and Joseph of Arimathea who shrouded him. But a little further down the slope, rather to one side, a man was standing with his eyes riveted on the dying man in the middle, watching his death throes from the first moment to the last. His name was Barabbas. This book is about him. Nice stuff, huh? Simple.
What do we know already? The first paragraph. Pardon me?
Yep. Already, if we could draw a picture of this scene, we've got Barabbas isolated from everybody else, watching him. And how does he watch? And I won't stop us like this every paragraph, I promise you. But I want to get it set up. Yeah, intense concentration. His eyes riveted. Watching his death throes from the first moment to the last. This has nothing to do with him. He'll say over and over again to the novel. Well, then we have a description of Barabbas. He was about 30, powerfully built with a sallow complexion, a reddish beard and black hair. His eyebrows also were black, his eyes too deep set, as though they wanted to hide. Under one of them he had a deep scar that was lost to sight in his beard. But a man's appearance is of little consequence. I'm going to erase and write that down. We don't want to forget it, that Logarthist, our author, has introduced us to this idea that appearance, oh, come on here, Green. Our homework, throw it. appearance is of no consequence. MCE out there, okay? He had followed the mob through the streets, all the way from the governor's palace, but at a distance, somewhat behind the others. When the exhausted rabbi had collapsed beneath his cross, he had stopped and stood still for a while to avoid catching up. And then they had got hold of that man, Simon, and forced him to carry it instead. There were not many men in the crowd, except the Roman soldiers, of course. They were mostly women, following the condemned man and a flock of urchins who were always there when anyone was led out along their street to be crucified. It made a change for them. But they soon tired and went back to their games, pausing a moment to glance at the man with the long scar on his cheek who was walking behind the others. Now, he was standing up here on the gallows hill looking at the man on the middle cross, unable to tear his eyes away. Actually, he had not wanted to come up here at all, for everything was unclean, full of contagion. If a man set foot in this potent and accursed place, part of him would surely remain, and he could be forced back there, never to leave it again. Skulls and bones lay scattered about everywhere, together with fallen, half-moldering crosses, no longer of any use, but left to lie there all the same, because no one would touch anything. Why was he standing here? He did not know this man, had nothing to do with him. What was he doing at Golgotha, he who had been released? What's your reaction? I'm not looking for an academic response. I'm looking for our guts. Please start the literature there.
Magnetic and golden.
is what a word, magnetic. Barabbas can't go away. Well, what can we imagine that is going on in Barabbas' mind? We don't have it yet in the story, but we can just add from our own myths and stories of Barabbas, we get that adds to our perspective on this magnetism of Jesus. To Barabbas, the crucified man's, and now I want you to listen carefully to this description. The crucified man's head hung down and he was breathing heavily. It would not be long now. There was nothing vigorous about the fellow. His body was lean and spindly, the arms slender as though they had never been put to any use. A queer man. The beard was sparse and the chest quite hairless, like a boy's. He did not like it. I like that description. I mean, Norwegian Jesus is gone in that one. Yeah, good. Part of that rationalization process. That's nice. How about you as a reader? What's happening to you now? And we all have our conceptions of Jesus. And now we've been told his body was lean and spindly, a queer man, but beard was sparse and the chest quite hairless. Very much the opposite of Barabbas, who's vigorous and strong. And you pointed to this. Go ahead. But appearance is no consequence. Sure. I used to have literature teachers tell me, well, art becomes life, and then I say, say it, I don't understand it. I never did understand it. So I'm not sure I do yet, but I think what someone means when they say art becomes life is when what happens to you, the reader, is the same thing that's happening to the character. Well, we have a character here, and I'll illustrate that, described in rather different terms than what you are accustomed to. No, for sure, all our paintings of Jesus, all the pictures that we have of Jesus on the cross, we never see him puny, or rarely. I'm not an art historian at all, but sparse, hairless chest, like a boy's. But a man's appearance is of no consequence. From the beginning, I'm on the second page of the novel. We as readers are asked to consider that truth, that a person's appearance is of no consequence. Because to Barabbas, it makes all the difference in the world. Who is this guy on the cross? What's Barabbas going to hear in a little while? Hey, did you hear? He calls himself the Son of Man.
Why not?
Well, some people say, I'll read you the scene. He was, it's hard for me to say, Son of God. No. A man's appearance has great consequences. The Son of God does not look like that. And everything that Barabbas had expected from the rumors floating around the town, and everything that we expect, has a lot to do with appearances of no consequence. Well, I'm going to skip way ahead, and not in the novel, but in some of the things that I'd like to have you think about as you read this novel, is that there has something to do with, I'll write two words on the board, secular and spiritual. And are our considerations of this Savior primarily secular? He must be powerfully built. He must be able to deliver. He must be able to, quote, save. And we have certain expectations then of what he should look like, too. Well, I'll read a little more. From the first moment Barabbas had seen him in the courtyard of the palace, he had felt there was something odd about him. What it was, he could not say. It was just something he felt. He didn't remember ever having seen anyone like him before. Though it must have been because he came straight from the dungeon and his eyes were still unused to the glare. That is why, at first glance, the man seemed to be surrounded by a dazzling light. Soon afterwards, the light vanished, of course, and his sight grew normal again and took in other things besides the figure standing out there alone in the courtyard. But he still thought there was something very strange about him, and not like anyone else. It seemed quite incredible that he was a prisoner and had been condemned to death, just as he himself had been. He could not grasp it. Not that it concerned him, but how could they pass a sentence like that? It was obvious his innocence. Another theme that runs through this, I think, has to do with our vision. And the two words, and you'll see it over and over again in the novel, is the settings of that take place in darkness and others that take place in light, and how the light is used to bring both sight to our eyes as readers and as characters in the book, but also light means something else in that old phrase. We say, ah, I see the light. Something to do with truth as well. Okay, Barabbas looks at Jesus, sees a light that thematically, I'm apologizing for jumping so far ahead and putting so much together, but I want to get your feedback in a second. He sees this light, and what does he do? Remember what he did? Yes. It's got to be my eyes. I've been down on myself too long. It can't be that somebody has a light around me. Well, that's the physical, secular light that he sees that suggests there may be something else there in the idea of light as well. What did Barabbas feel about the whole situation now, do you think? I just, the paragraph I ended with, it's obvious he's innocent. Again, your guts.
If I were Barabbas, I think I'd feel intrigued.
Yeah. And that's a good word for it. He surely is intrigued. I mean, who is this guy? And this wimpy, puny man has this what? Power over him to come up there on this hill full of contagion and to watch from the beginning to the end and to follow along. I mean, he makes a pretty concerted effort, doesn't he, to get up there and see this whole thing. When he says what? It obviously had nothing to do with me. But. And there's always that but. I wrote some questions, and I've already asked them, but I want to put them together in a, just so you hear them all together, and then to set up something else. I asked this question, what is faith? Then I asked, I just showed us what the picture that we get on the gallows hill, and the picture was, as you said, Barabbas is alone, there's a crowd up around Jesus, okay? And then I asked, what is your reaction to the description of Jesus? And then I asked just now, what did Barabbas feel about Jesus? And then what did Barabbas feel about the situation? If we took time, and we don't have that kind of time, to ask these questions, and discuss them at length, I would suggest to you that we're using a certain kind of thinking to answer those questions. When we ask, well, how does Barabbas feel? We're going by the perceptions that we gain from the information told us in the story. And that those perceptions are based upon only the concrete images that the story gives us. And that then our truth or our understanding of the situation is based upon those concrete images. Puny. Scar in his face, that's Barabbas. Heavy beard, puny, and a hairless chest and so on. Okay. Why was he looking at him and not at the one in the middle who was hanging there in his stead? It's because of him he had come. This man had forced him up here. He had a strange power over him. Power. If anyone looked powerless, he did. Appearance is of no consequence. Well, watch Barabbas. He raised his head, this is Jesus, a bit all the same, the lean, hairless chest heaved with panting, and his tongue licked his parched lips. He groaned something about being thirsty. The soldiers who were sprawled over a game of dice a little further down the slope, bored because the men hanging there took so long to die, did not hear.
But one of the relatives went down and told him. A soldier got up reluctantly and dipped the sponge in the pitcher, passing it up to him on a stick. But when he tasted the fusty, tainted liquid offered him, he did not want it. The wretch just stood there, grinning, and when he joined his companions, they all lay grinning at what had happened. The bastards. What's happened?
Compassion.
Yeah. And he's hooked. In the short, I'm on page 9. It starts on page 4.
And already we've had Barabbas go from this kind of, I don't care observer, but we see him compelled, intrigued. But now it's more than just psychological, mental intrigue. Bastards. He's made a judgment, hasn't he? And he's got... Go, that's good.
It connects with a similar experience of a number of, sometimes in prisons in South Africa. You have your regular hardcore criminals, and then in a number of occasions, priests or pastors who will go in, and the initial response is always, you know, these people are so puny, they obviously can't be guilty. But as they start to challenge the prison authorities, the regular prisoners soon take a very deep liking to them and start having that kind of, you know,
yeah.
They see that they're also against the police, yes. And so there comes up the whole, the bastards effect, and you're on our side, even though we don't understand what the hell you're in here for,
yeah.
And we'd probably disagree if we did understand, but you're here with us, and you're against them, and...
Yes, and that's really good. Well, I'll summarize for you. Barabbas sees darkness come over the hill, and he leaves. And he goes to a tavern, and there in the tavern, he's trying to get back to normal life, and just kind of, his friends talk to him. Come now, have a drink and cheer up. Aren't you glad you're out of it? Aren't you glad you're out of it and sitting here enjoying yourself among friends instead of hanging and rotting on a cross? Isn't this better, eh? Aren't you having a good time here, eh? Think of that, Barabbas. You saved your bacon. You're alive. You're alive.
Barabbas. Yes. Yes, of course, he said. Of course. To me, that's a powerful scene.
In the understanding of the vision that the characters in this book have, what is life? You're alive, Barabbas. You've saved your bacon. Life equals bacon. But Barabbas is no dummy here on page 20. He's still early in the book. We love this guy. It won't take you long. You're alive, Barabbas. There's more to life than saving your bacon. And it suggests something already about this powerful theme that runs through the whole novel. The difference between a secular view of what life is and a spiritual view. And Barabbas' search, now it begins, is for some kind of spiritual meaning in his life. And it's more than saving his bacon. And now he'll make all kinds of gestures toward faith. That's why, remember the list we had up here. What is faith? And Barabbas is going to search for that so hard. And he tries with everything that's in him to come to some kind of faith. But he keeps using the wrong kind of vision to realize faith. In a short story by Carl Lagerfeld, a long short story that you would read only after you've read everything else he's written, it's called The Eternal Smile. In that story, there's a character who says, I maintain that few people have really lived. This character speaking is someone that's already dead, and the whole story takes place up in the land of the dead, or a kind of a heaven, I guess. And these people are in the darkness, and they're searching God, searching out God. And one of the characters says, I would maintain that very few people have really lived. Speaking with the vision about what life is to live in the spiritual sense. Most people live so much in the secular world. Well, Barabbas struggles in that secular world trying to make sense out of his life. And here's step number one. And I wish this were my idea, but it's not, the literary critics who ask these questions. What is a man or a woman in the face of the universe he or she cannot understand. What is the man or woman in the face of a universe that they didn't make? What is a man or a woman in the face of a universe they absurdly try to ignore or tragically try to make gestures of meaning? Barabbas makes all kinds of tragic gestures. Number one, to get back to the life of the bacon and understand his life, he has sex with a fat woman. I'd like to reread the scene to you. It's not a novel written in 1986, it's a novel written in 1951, therefore you don't have to be on the edge of your seat or anything. In the tavern, a fat woman kind of pulls him over and says, isn't it time now we get back to living? And Barabbas is half drunk by now, and he says, I guess. When the fat woman and Barabbas were thus left alone, she asked if he didn't think it was about time they too enjoyed themselves together, if he wasn't in need of it after having been treated so badly. She, for her part, greatly fancied one who had languished so long in prison and so nearly been crucified. She took him up under the roof where she had a little arbor made of palm leaves for the hot time of the year. They lay down and she fondled him a little while, and he grew quite wild, wallowing in her fat body as though he never wanted to leave it. I think there's a purpose in her being fat, and I want to share that with you. It intensifies the physicalness of this relationship. And that's the point. It is only physical, and watch what happens. He wallows in her fat, and half the night passed by without their being conscious of anything around him. When at last they were quite spent, she turned over on her side and fell asleep at once. He lay awake beside her sweaty body, looking up at the roof of the arbor, and he thought of the man on the middle cross and what had happened up there on the gallows. I'll skip a couple lines. Could it be, as they said, merely something he had imagined, the darkness? Or perhaps it was something up there at Golgotha, that they had not noticed anything here in the city. Up there, anyway, it had been dark. The soldiers had been scared in one thing or another, or had he imagined that too? No, he could not work it out. Didn't know what to make of it. And Barabbas thought of him again, the man on the cross. What's the sentence? The juxtaposition of this physicalness with his spiritual wonder. He lay with his eyes open, unable to speak, feeling the woman's fleshly body against him. And through the dry leaves of the roof, he could see up into the sky. It must be the sky with no stars or be seen, nothing but the darkness. For now it was dark, both at Golgotha and everywhere else. Tragic gesture number one in the novel. I can get back into normal living. And I've saved my bacon, and all I have to do is go back like I was. I was a criminal, I was a robber, I was a murderer, I was a thief, and you'll read a little bit about that, not much. And I had women when I wanted them, and I got drunk, and he starts step number one, get drunk and have women. Didn't work. Freed or condemned? Well, then Barabbas has to know more. He talks with Peter, and I'm going to really go fast so that we don't. He talks with Peter, but it's a wonderful scene. He wants to know a little bit more about him, and Peter tells him that Jesus said he's going to rise from the dead. Rise from the dead? What nonsense. It's not nonsense. Indeed, he will. Many even think it will be tomorrow morning, for that was the third day. He was supposed to have said that he would remain in hell for 3 days, though I never heard him say so. But that's what he's supposed to have said. And at sunrise tomorrow, Barabbas gave a shrug. Don't you believe it? No. No, how can you? You have never known him. But many of us believe. Of course, it is true. He has power. They even say that when the new age will begin, the happy age, and the Son of Man will reign in his kingdom, Barabbas interrupts him. The Son of Man? Yes, that's what he called himself. The Son of Man? Yes, so he said, but some will be. No, I can't say. Barabbas moved closer to him. This guy's on a head built trip, at least. What do they believe? They believe that he is God's own son. God's son? Yes, but surely that can't be true. It's almost enough to make one afraid.
I would really much rather he came back as he was. Barabbas was quite worked up.
There's Lagerfist's simplicity.
Well, then he's heard about this resurrection, and here is a powerful scene, I think. He goes out to see the resurrection not occur, so he can comfortably believe that this was not the Son of God. And he sneaks up and he hides behind a bush and he doesn't see anything. And then a woman, who in here is just labeled the harlot, we never know her name or anything, she has seen the resurrection. And she comes up to Barabbas and did you see? He said, I didn't see anything. First he rationalizes. The stone had been rolled away the whole time before he ever came. And the sepulchre had been empty even then. Who had rolled it aside and who had made off with the dead man was not hard to guess. The disciples had, of course, done it sometime during the night. Under cover of darkness, they had carried off their adored and beloved master so as to be able to say later that he had risen from the dead, just as he had predicted it. It wasn't hard to work that out. That's his rationalization for it. Then the hair-lipped girl comes up and says, I saw it. He barely heard her whisper to herself, the Son of God is risen. It gave him a queer feeling to hear her say it. Against his will, he felt something he couldn't make out what. He stood there for a moment, not knowing what to say or do. Then he went up to the sepulchre as he thought of it, and he made sure it was empty. But he knew that already, and it meant nothing one way or the other. Then he went back to where she was kneeling. Her face was so reverent and full of rapture that he really felt sorry for her. There was no truth at all in this thing that made her happy. She described rapturously and in detail how an angel in a mantle of fire came rushing down. She gives a description and Barabbas says, he looked down and said that he had not seen it. And deep down inside he thought how very pleased he was not to have seen it. It showed that his eyes were all right now, like everybody else's eyes. That he no longer saw visions, but only reality itself. Reality, vision, truth. What kinds of distinctions do we make among the meanings of those words? Reality for Barabbas is physically, you have to see it. It's the opposite end of the things that we suggested faith was. And truth then lies only in what category here? Vision. So watch that in the whole novel, that when there's dark and you can't see, and then in the middle of my book, it's dark and you can't see, it has something to do with his vision isn't there. And without this vision, no truth. And the vision, always in this novel for Barabbas, comes back to the secular. I'm going to skip ahead so we can talk about our own faith and how Barabbas is that. Barabbas' journey is, I think, one that tries to make the leap from certainty to doubt. We've all been there. Certainty was when we were four. We knew that everything was literal and everything was simple. And then doubt creeps in, and we either die in that age of doubt or we rise up to doubt to certainty to doubt. Then it's not certainty anymore, it's faith. And it's that list that you created for us. Barabbas is trying to make that move out of certainty and deal with his doubt and come to faith, and he never can. Listen to how bad he wants it, though. And this is the last thing I'll read. He does a lot of things that are trying to make sense out of his life. And one of the things that happens to him is that he's put in a cave, in the copper mine, where he lives for many years in the complete darkness of the mine. And he's chained to another fellow. They are released. While they were down there, the other fellow talked to Barabbas about Jesus and got Barabbas to carve on the disc hanging from a chain around his neck that showed he was a property of Rome, his slave's disc. On the back side of it, he carved the name Jesus Christ.
because his friend believed in Jesus Christ and had that name, and Jesus Christ was his God. Well, Barabbas did that too. But then they're questioned by the Roman governor. Hey, man, you got the government disc on there, on the back it says Jesus Christ. What does that mean? Let's have a little explanation. So his friend, Sahak, responds to the governor's question and says, who is that? Sahak, Barabbas' mind partner. It is my God. Sahak answered with a slight tremor in his voice. Aha! It is a name I cannot remember having heard before, but then there are so many gods, one can't keep track of them all. Is it the God of your native province? This is the governor speaking. No. It's everybody's God. Everybody's. You don't say so. It's not at all bad. And I have never even heard of him. He keeps his renown somewhat secret, if I may say so. Yes, said Sarah. Everybody's God. In that case, he must have more than a little power. What does he base it on? On love. A theme that runs through the book is Barabbas struggles to find love and never does. And I think one of Logarthus' ideas is that love is the vehicle that brings us to faith. It makes us, we can understand and feel love, and it helps us identify with the abstractness of faith. Love, well, why not? Any waste will concern of mine, you can believe as you like about it, but tell me, why do you bear his name on your slave's disc? Because I belong to him. Are you not a state slave? Sahak made no reply. He merged to looking down the floor. At last the Roman said, but not at all unkindly. You must answer this. We must be quite clear on this point, don't you see? Do you belong to the state? Tell me now. I belong to the Lord my God, said Sahak without looking up. The governor stood regarding him, and he lifted Sahak's head and looked into his burnt up face, that's from being down the mine. The face that had been at the smelting furnace. He said nothing, and after a time, when he had seen what he wanted, he let go of the other man's chin. Then he went and stood in front of Barabbas. I want you to know it means death if you don't claim Rome to be your worship. He stood in front of Barabbas and he turned over his slave fist in the same way, he asked, and you? Do you also believe in this loving God? Barabbas made no reply. Tell me, do you? Barabbas shook his head. You don't? Why do you bear his name on your disc then? Barabbas was silent as before. Is he not your God? Isn't that what the inscription means? I have no God. Barabbas answered at last so softly that it could hardly be heard. But Sahak and the Roman both heard it. And Sahak gave him a look so full of despair, pain, and amazement at his incredible words that Barabbas felt it pass right through him, right into his inmost being, even though he did not meet the other's eyes. The Roman, too, seemed surprised. But I don't understand, he said. Why, then, do you bear this Christothesis carved on your disc? Because I want to believe, Barabbas said without looking up in the mirror. You have to read the story to find out how it comes out. But the longing for faith is so powerful in the mouth, and all the gestures he makes to come to faith, and he does things like he revenges the death of the harlot who saw the resurrection. She claims she saw it, they kill her for blasphemy, and he avenges the death, saying, if Jesus is a savior, why doesn't he save? At least I avenged her death. And he kills the guy who threw the first stone. He carves the slave disc with Jesus Christ's name. He later helps Christians, he thinks, burn Rome. And he makes all these gestures to say he's come to faith. I'm sorry I've cut so much into your time. I try to cover one novel in 20 minutes. Good. That's really good. Now I'm going to add a word out of Luther 2. Certainty to doubt, and I mentioned the word faith. Another way is to combine those two stages. That in doubt, can Barabbas attain peace, even with his doubt? And that's part of what you're saying and what's going on in the novel, too. He hears about Lazarus, by the way, another incident in the novel, wonderful incident. And he goes up to see Lazarus and he talks to him. And the first thing he says, what's that like? Read the book to find out the answer.
I remember. Yes. Little.
It's just like what Advent is to me. You know, Advent becomes little pieces of time when you get to the.
Yeah, that's very. Yeah. That's very nice. And each week is a little more light. Yeah, that's good.
It reminds me of, I'm in teaching confirmation class, of the number of the kids who so badly want to be confirmed because they think that in being confirmed, it'll all fall into place. And it's almost like writing that name on the disc. I mean, that's in a sense what confirmation is. And there's such a deep, I mean, they see this Jesus in the confirmation class and we talk about it and we discuss faith, and they so badly want it. And yet sometimes I've had to counsel them not to be confirmed because that's not what confirmation is.
Right.
And it's that whole kind of longing. I mean, this has happened to me I connect a lot with the story as well. So it's not just people out there, but it is interesting how that whole struggle comes in. And they'll come to me and they'll talk about things or they'll go and speak to people and there's a real search, but never able to take that leap, almost. It's got to be
there's
time.
The leap is part good.
Garrison Keillor told a beautiful story about that a while back. I won't tell the whole story, but the gist of it was that a girl was confirmed and Keillor was invited to come to the family farm, to the house, to the celebration. The girl came back home to the house and all the relatives were there, and she felt so guilty because she doubted and felt like she had lied, and so she finally could stand it no longer and she rushed out of the house and ran away and then bumped into Keillor as he was coming on the road. But the idea that she thought she had confessed more than she really believed, and the difficulty of balancing doubt with confession.
Yeah.
Nice story.
One of the things you can do, I point out to you, is that throughout this book, and it's clear to us in the beginning that here's two literary terms you want to hear and then never remember again. The protagonist is kind of the hero. Now, I like these phrases because they're opposites. The protagonist is Barabbas, and the antagonist is the person that works against him, in this case, is Jesus. Well, not only are they physically the protagonist and the antagonist, but also what they do and how they live. And notice that Barabbas, in his attempts at gaining the truth, looks for logic and reason and physical acts, and then compare with what you understand Jesus to have done throughout the New Testament with logic, with physical shows of power and proof, the kinds of things that Barabbas is expecting and that all the Jews expected, and why that's what they crucified him. Compare those differences too, and you'll see that the Jesus of our New Testament is also an antagonist to the Barabbas' life as well. Anything else? Part of what goes on in a good novel is that it's written, the story unfolds to create for us, the readers, a new insight and a new way to see things. And one of the, to put it simply with the images in the novel, we begin to see that life is more than saving your bacon. And that seeing things, anything, only in the secular terms, reduces life, whereas seeing things in the spiritual realm makes life bigger. In another book that Lagerfist wrote, called The Holy Land. He has a trilogy called The Death of Azarus, Pilgrim at Sea, and The Holy Land. A wonderful three books that are all very short and very hard to understand. I don't think I do. But at the end, the pilgrim has been searching so long to come to God, every book perhaps writes, and Lagerfist writes, has to do with coming to God and understanding and finding some sense of relationship with God. The pilgrim gets to the end of the journey and says, in God I will never believe, because God and all the plaster saints
that men and women have reduced him to is unbelievable. But beyond that is the divine, something which I know exists and I know to be true. What Lagerfeld is suggesting is the secular look at what? Institution, and I mean, in this, I'm not saying we adapt this, but I'm saying this is Lagerfeld. Institutionalized faith, doctrinalized faith. Anything that has to do with ritual and liturgy or any of that, Lagerfeld suggests beyond it is where we have to see into the spiritual existence that I know exists. But here's where Lagerfeld, I think, differs from Barabbas. But I cannot understand. But the pilgrim, doesn't he have faith? But I know it exists. Anybody else?
There's a Rilke quotation. I've never read a whole book, but it's about loving the question, living the question. I guess I feel I'm in that doubt, you know, a lot. But rather than be afraid of it and try to hide from it, to live it and love it, and someday you will, whatever the quote is, you'll find that.
Plug the book, hear that? 30 years later, 10 minutes ago. I read it 10 minutes ago, it got a lot of it. You're smarter than this. Anybody else? It's a story of faith, in coming to faith, and struggling with the doubt. Do you have a chance?
Does the Catholic rest mean?
No. Hebrew for our
Son of the Father. One of the ironies we made was between one Son of the Father and three Sons of the Father.
I don't know. Or I don't know that Locke was moving. He studied the Bible a lot. But I think, like a good Lutheran, he studied the Bible and not linguistics and history and rejected.
What extent does he play on the setting up that theme where a person's life is saved by Christ's death on the cross? I mean, that's a powerful parable of salvation in a way. Does he play that throughout? I mean, is there ever a point where Barabbas reaches the point of recognizing why he found Christ on the cross so powerful, that sense of release, salvation, which...
I think I follow your question. The ending of the story, I can tell you, Barabbas is crucified himself. And he dies on the cross, looking up into the darkness, and he says, "To thee I deliver up my soul." Deliberately and powerfully ambiguous. Who, what is thee? I think you can read fine critics who will say, Jesus, André Gide says, the Galilean God. Well, it's more consistent that the Galilean didn't get him, and that Barabbas says in the darkness, to thee I deliver up my soul, once again projecting himself into the darkness that I... But maybe he's found peace. Not salvation, but peace. From what I know about Lagerfeld, and if I understand your question right too, is that that would shift the story to being more of a God-centered story and less of a man-centered story, or human, you know. And I don't think it does that. Thank you.